This is an oral history interview of Geraldine W. Johnson, former Bridgeport Superintendent of Schools, which was done for the Afro-American Educators Association Black Oral History Program. It was recorded on November 17, 1983, by Association member Denise Foster Bay. The tape will begin in a few moments.
Mrs. Johnson, we're going to begin with your early childhood. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself as a child, your birth, your parents, and what Bridgeport was like when you were younger?
Well, I was born in Bridgeport more than a half century ago, and to a large family. I grew up in a family of seven children and with very loving parents, whom I felt demanded a great deal of us. Grew up in the east end of Bridgeport. At that time, there were very few blacks in Bridgeport. You might find a group of blacks in the south end of Bridgeport, and some, very few, in the north end of Bridgeport, and another section in the east end of Bridgeport. And most of the people who were black you would know. It was a small community of blacks, and of course they worshiped together and had a lot of their social affairs together. So I grew up knowing other blacks, but it was just a small group of blacks in Bridgeport. I did attend local schools along with my sisters and my one brother, McKinley School in the East End, from which I graduated and years later went back and taught school at that same East End school. I cannot say that I grew up without a great deal of prejudice around me, because if you were black, you were different, because there were so few of us. And I can't say that I wasn't called names and that I didn't face some discrimination. But I think that because some of us came from very strong families, maybe I ought to take that off. The fact that some of us came from very strong families and we were given a pride in whom we were and a pride about being black, and of course then the word was Negro. It wasn't black. We were called colored or Negro. If someone called you a name that wasn't very complimentary, in fact, which was insulting to you, we were just taught to ignore it because we had been given perfectly good names. And I think we were given a fair amount of strength from our parents to be proud of whom we were.
Were your parents born in this area?
Both of my parents come from Virginia, one from Mecklenburg County, way down at the southern tip of Virginia, and my mother from Fauquier County up near Washington, but had been in Bridgeport for a long time.
Do you remember why they came to Bridgeport?
Well, for new kinds of opportunities. Bridgeport, for at the time that my parents came, was a light industrial place to come, with entry-level jobs for people. My father came here and got a job in Bridgeport Brass Shop and became one of their power mechanics in Bridgeport Brass Shop. My mother came here with her family because her father was looking for some new opportunities in the north. And so they kind of migrated here in order to get jobs in an industrial city.
Now, you mentioned that many of the blacks in the city at the time socialized together. What kinds of places did you go to?
Well, we had a YWCA in those days, and it was the Phyllis Wheatley YWCA, and it was a separate YWCA. It was a YWCA on Beach Street in the east side of Bridgeport, to which we could walk, And they had girl reserves, and they had little bluebird clubs, and they had dancing classes, and they had all kinds of little clubs. And it was really kind of a haven for black people. And so my mother was on the board of managers of that Phyllis Wheatley branch, YWCA, and we grew up going to the Y for dancing lessons and for clubs and for things like that. Other than that, you socialize by being part of church clubs that your parents were, the churches that your parents were involved in. You participated in school events. You took lessons and had lots to do because you, in those days, you took music lessons, you took dancing lessons, and you took all kinds of lessons that kept you busy. At least my family did. I'm not sure that all families did, but my family kept us awfully busy with music lessons because we were a musical family, and with little clubs that we were in, mostly under the aegis of the YWCA, mm-hmm. the Phyllis Wheatley mm-hmm. branch. And of course we were proud because Phyllis Wheatley was one of our black poets, whom I understand lived in Connecticut for a while. And this branch was named in honor of her, and had mostly, well, had all black participants mm-hmm. in it. And it did mean at that time that we were not welcome mm-hmm. at the main YWCA to be members. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the discriminatory process that I think I'm talking about, that there was truly a separation of the races. We could be educated together, but when it came to socialization, and somewhat when it came to worship, churches were separate and social institutions were pretty separate in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
What church did you attend?
Well, some neighbors of ours who were white neighbors came to our house and asked my mother if they could take us to church. So I grew up in basically a white church. They took us to a neighborhood church, which was Newfield Methodist Church on the corner of Central Avenue and Stratford Avenue. And whereas my mother was organist of AME Zion Church in the south end of Bridgeport, it was fairly expensive to take up this whole family of children, which had to go by bus then, or trolley car, across town to church. So she was very happy to have the neighbors take us down to Newfield Church, another Methodist church. And we grew up in the Sunday school and the church of Newfield Methodist Church just because it was in our neighborhood, and we could go. We could walk down to church. So I did grow up in, my father attended Messiah Baptist Church. My mother attended Walters Memorial AME Zion Church, and we visited those churches a good deal with mm-hmm. our parents. But each Sunday, we walked down to Sunday school, and we became members of Newfield Methodist Church in the east end of Bridgeport, just three blocks from our home. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned discrimination in Bridgeport and just generally that you experienced as you were growing up. What was the relationship between teachers and students at that time? Did you have any black teachers? Did you have any problems with white teachers?
Well, my mother's sister, Lillian Whiting, was the first black teacher in Bridgeport. She attended Bridgeport Normal School, graduated from there, and became a special education teacher in McKinley School, just two blocks away from where we lived. She was my godmother, and I always had great liking and respect for her, and she probably was one of the reasons why I decided to become a teacher. She did not have an easy time becoming a teacher. She didn't have that difficult time finishing school. But because she was black, they implied that it was going to be very hard for her to get a job. However, she did. She got a job. And for a while, she was the only black teacher in Bridgeport. However, she, in those days, if you married, you could not teach. And she, shortly after she started teaching for a year or two, she became engaged and got married. And of course, she had to stop teaching. There was another black woman in Bridgeport prepared, however, to go into teaching, and that was Marion Williams, Marion Williams Jennings now. And Marion became, Mrs. Williams, Mrs. Jennings now, became a teacher, and for a very long period of time was the only black teacher in Bridgeport. I guess I have to say I was the third black teacher in Bridgeport. And when I taught, when I began teaching in 1944, Marion Jennings and I were the only two black teachers with the in the elementary schools, with the exception of Robert Thompson, who had become a teacher in a high school teacher. And so for a very long time, the three of us were the only ones teaching in Bridgeport. And I say discrimination because although there had been two others who went into teaching and who had gotten positions in Bridgeport, when I graduated from Harding High School and was slated to go to Bridgeport Normal School, I was told, I was very frankly being discouraged from going, because, and the reason was that the advisor at Harding High School was very busy telling me that she had no doubt but that I could get through school because I was an honor student, but that when I would get through, I'd have a very hard time getting a job because white parents would not want me to teach their children. Now, to me, that's discriminatory.
Right.
And if I hadn't had strong parents who insisted that they were paying taxes and that, yes, I would go to that school, you know, I, too, might not have pursued
was the
teaching
Bridgeport,
as a profession.
Normal school, was that almost like a public school? Or?
It was a city supported school to train all of the elementary teachers that would teach in the Bridgeport elementary schools. If you didn't come out of the Bridgeport Normal School at the time when I grew up, you could not get an elementary position in Bridgeport. All of the teachers that taught in Bridgeport were the product of the Bridgeport Normal School until it became a defunct institution in 1939. But up until that time, from its early beginnings way back there in the early 1900s or the late 1800s, that is the school that produced all of the elementary teachers
at
Bridgeport.
Where was that located?
It was on Warren Street in the south end of Bridgeport, which later it became Roosevelt School. It was in the old Roosevelt School, which was on Warren Street and Prospect Street in Bridgeport. And it was the training institution for the elementary teachers. And I did go there and graduated from there. When I graduated, it was a three-year institution, and you had to take your fourth year at one of the state teachers' colleges. So I went to New Haven Teachers College and got my degree right after the three years at Bridgeport Normal School. You got your fourth year in the state teachers' college. But again, you know, it was the strength of adults and the older people in Bridgeport who just helped overcome some of the discrimination by being determined that their children, their young people were going to get what was due them. And so, you know, some of those battles were very subtly fought and won because they should have been.
Were there any black political organizations that you were aware of as you were growing up?
Well, NACP was an institution that was very important. I remember my father used to go to all the Tuesday night meetings that they held somewhere on Stratford Avenue. And I grew up knowing that there was an NACP and that it was a strong institution to support the rights of black people. That was the main one. I think that the black churches in Bridgeport have always been strong institutions because you always felt you could go to the black minister and ask for support or for help for projects or things that you felt need to be accomplished. Mm-hmm. So I would say that the black church was a very strong institution, and so was the NACP as I came along.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to kind of skip World War One, unless you can recall anything that you might have picked up as you were growing up about the effects of World War I on the population of Bridgeport?
I really don't know too much about that. World War I was before I came along.
Right.
So I don't know too much about that.
What recollections do you have of the Depression era?
I grew up in the Depression.
Right. What was Bridgeport like? What was it? How did it fare through that period?
Well, I'm sure that by any yardstick that you would measure today, that I grew up in a family that was basically poor. You know, poor from not having a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But I never felt disadvantaged because there were ways that families those days could cope with not having a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So I cannot say that I ever felt poor, because I know that my mother did not work. She took care of the family. My father worked every day, but in order to overcome some of the necessities or the lack of money to buy a lot of necessities for a big family, we're a family of nine, there were a lot of things that our family did. My father had gardens and raised all of the vegetables that we ate, and we bought no vegetables. He raised the fruits and vegetables, and we canned them in the summertime. Maybe young people don't know what canning is. Now you freeze things, but in those days you washed glass jars and you had boilers that you put these glass jars filled with fruits and vegetables in, and you canned your fruits to prepare for wintertime when you did not have those. My mother sewed and made all of our clothes, so we didn't go without appropriate clothing because she sewed and taught us how to sew. And when they canned, we had to help with that. We all had chores to do. We all had help that we had to give at home. For instance, my father would buy coal, and I remember they would bring coal and dump it outside our cellar window. My father would be very busy shoveling the coal from outside into a coal bin that you would have in your cellar. And even though we were girls and there was only one boy, we all came home from school, changed our clothes. There were such things as school clothes and home clothes those days. You changed your clothes in order to save your clothes so that they would be good. And you would get into your everyday clothes and you would help with chores. Or he would buy wood and they would come and dump the wood outside the cellar window, and we would all get out there and help to heave the wood from outside into the wood bin in order to have heat that we needed. And that saved a great deal of money because we could not afford to buy the kinds of services that made it easier for a family to have those things. Of course, the dollar went a great deal further in those days than it does today. But with only having to buy the meat that a family would eat, producing all the vegetables and fruits and the clothing, and living simply, we were able to make it through a depression and even help some other people who were poor. But the spirit of families helping each other and the spirit of neighbors helping each other. We were the only black people on our street, but the whites were very good neighbors to us, and we were good neighbors to them. And we had some very poor neighbors that would come over and borrow sugar or borrow flour. We never borrowed anything because my mother didn't believe in borrowing. But if someone came to the house and asked for something because they had families and they needed something, that even though we were a big family, and basically I felt we were poor, there was always enough to help somebody else have a meal, or to send somebody a box of something, or to take somebody some vegetables, or to share. So I do remember the Depression. I don't think we suffered from it, however. I think it gave us some strength that later on we could use all the rest of our lives in knowing how to take care of our finances, take care of our possessions, respect property, know that things don't come easy to a lot of people, and that you take care of things and you know how to put things together. We ate a lot of soup, a lot of stews, and a lot of the kinds of things my mother knew how to prepare, the stretched meals that were very nourishing, were very good, but weren't fancy. So how to feed a family, I think all of us know how to do, because we grew up in a depression and we were well nourished and well clothed. And I have lots of memories of the depression and people suffering.
Do you remember seeing, were there soup lines and things like that in Bridgeport?
I don't recall soup lines in our particular area, but yes, there were soup lines in Bridgeport. And there were places where people could get, you know, help that they needed because they just didn't have resources during that time. They were pretty tough times for people, but I just think that my family protected us from those tough times because we all pitched in, and we didn't know how tough it might have been for other people who didn't have those same resources.
But you said that your father was employed the
Oh, my father was never,
time.
I never remember in life that he was out of work. He was employed, but didn't make a great deal of money, and less during the times of, of depression.
Right. Were there any more black people living in the area? Did the population of the...
Not during the depression. The population, the black population in Bridgeport, didn't increase until the Second World War.
Right.
And at that time, many, many people came into Bridgeport for Remington Arms, GE, and the airplane factories, especially Remington and GE. Lots of people, and some of the steel mills and things. They came from all over, especially out of the South, North, because it was around the clock work, and people were looking, the industries were looking for employees, and evidently put out the call all over the country, and lots of people came. People were renting rooms. Some of them were renting rooms in shifts. Bridgeport stayed lit up 24 hours, day and night, and it was not unusual that there were three shifts in most of these factories, and the factories were humming, and the whole city was extremely busy, but that was the Second World War.
Now, during the, just about the time that the United States got involved in the Second World War, you started teaching, or just before?
I started teaching in 1944. And we had, you know, we had gotten into the war, in 1944.
How, before you started teaching, did you or your sisters and your brother, did you try to get jobs in any of these factories? Was it difficult for blacks to be employed in these places?
I came out of school in 1940, and I didn't have there wasn't any teaching job for me at that time. I substituted for a few years before I got a regular job teaching, and I substituted in the Bridgeport schools. You had to, if you graduated from normal school, you waited for your turn on the list to be appointed. Wherever you were in your class, you knew when you were going to be appointed. You knew who was before you, who was after you. You knew whether the class before you had exhausted its list, and you were appointed by the year you graduated, by your standing in the class, etc. So I knew, you know, I could keep track of about when I might expect to be appointed, and I knew it would be a few years. I basically substituted, and I didn't have any trouble getting substitute jobs. I was prepared to go out every day, sometimes to different schools, sometimes to stay a week, 2 or 3 weeks, but I was able to live at home and to work and save a little money. And I finally, you're married before I got my permanent job, had a baby before I got my permanent job, and right after I had my baby, I was called to teach and got a permanent job. So it wasn't that difficult. I think everyone knew that there was no way of avoiding giving me a job because I had come through the normal mm-hmm. school. I was on a list. They couldn't really skip mm-hmm. over me without a truly legal mm-hmm. case. At the time of the war, most of my sisters were either in high school, one was out at Fisk University, one had taken up hairdressing and was working at that time with my mother, who owned and operated a beauty shop. By those years, her family had grown, and she decided that she'd like to go into beauty culture. So she went to school, got her a license, and opened a beauty shop, and my sister worked with her. Everyone else was in school mm-hmm. and was not looking for a job. Mm-hmm. We never really got into working in the war industries mm-hmm. because we were either in school or involved right. in some other way.
Now you mentioned that after the war and during the war, the population of Bridgeport just exploded as everybody moved in. Were there pockets of black neighborhoods around? Were blacks able to come in and live anywhere, or did they still have certain pockets?
There still were pockets. Mm-hmm. The people who came in during the war years either rented or got rooms in black homes in those same pockets that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. The east end of Bridgeport, the south end of Bridgeport, a few in the north end, mm-hmm. and a few in the west end. Basically, the families that had been here for many years opened their homes and took people in. I remember that my mother on the top floor of our house had some rooms, and some of the people who worked up at GE and could walk right up Central mm-hmm. Avenue. Several of the rooms on the top floor of our house, it had three floors, lived there and went up to the factories to work. Many families opened their homes and rooms they weren't using, they rented out to people. Or if they had friends who had any space, the areas that were already existing began to bulge mm-hmm. with lots of people
right.
coming in. I did not see that a lot of areas got expanded into streets and sections that mm-hmm. had not had many blacks
before.
On them.
What about the relations between the blacks and the whites at this time? Did it feel any strain as more and more blacks came into the area?
I don't think at that particular time there was a great deal of strain. Everybody was too busy working, and working some more than one shift, mm-hmm. and just being relieved to get home and relax. I don't think that there was an opportunity, except that in the Second World War, the Army and Navy and Air Force opened up, mm-hmm. and so there was no further discrimination in the services. And it gave much more of an opportunity for blacks and whites and all ethnic groups to relate to each other, which was sort of a cornerstone in our history. However, back home, life went on and people stayed very, very busy in the war effort, having not a great deal of time to socialize, mm-hmm. not a great deal of time to sound each other out for opinions and et cetera. A lot of the factories, however, that had not heretofore had a great many blacks working in them, had many more blacks than ever because they had put out the call for mm-hmm. employees, and many blacks answered that call. So that was kind of new mm-hmm. to some of the factories who weren't used to having a great many blacks work for them.
And how was it in the school system? By this time you were working, and did you have any big problems or little problems or anything?
No, the schools were fairly unchanged. By that time we had a few projects that had been built. I taught at Prospect School in the South End as my first job, and at that time Marina Village and the Marina Apartments mm-hmm. and the Pequannock had opened, and there were a great many more blacks in the South End. Mm-hmm. And so I had a well-integrated classroom. You know, I mm-hmm. had blacks, I had whites. By no means was it, heavily populated by minorities mm-hmm. in the school where I taught, but there were a number of blacks. Getting along very well, At that time, I would say fairly well motivated, mm-hmm. with teachers who cared a great deal. I remember teaching with one teacher who was godmother to most of the black children. They loved her, and she was their godmother. Uh-huh. She's still alive, and she has more godchildren down the South End and had been in Prospect School for many years. And